The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to What About Wealth? Making it, investing it, protecting it, leaving a legacy with your hosts, Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. In today's economy, preserving wealth has become more important than ever, especially when it comes to our future generations. Now, here is Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee.
Good morning, everyone. This is Rich Bloomfield.
Good morning, good morning. This is Rick Durfee.
I'm the CPA in the group, and messed up Rick's intro here, but
it's okay. I'm the lawyer in the group, and it's okay. We do that to each other.
So we note at the beginning of every show, because we think that we're somewhat unique, is that we work together because we feel like it's in the client's best interest to do that. We know it's unusual in today's world, but we usually have to be separate on everything and make it difficult, run up more fees, and that's why we don't do that, because client gets the best answer if we work together. So, Rick, any comments on that?
No, that's what we love to do, work together. You know, when the lawyer and the CPA talk with each other, the client is better served. And I always tell people, if you ever get conflicting advice from your lawyer or your CPA, between the two of them, one of them doesn't know all the facts. And if they share information, they will give you consistent advice, and that's crucial to the planning process. So that's the basis for our show. We like to talk about issues that affect your wealth, and then bring both the accounting and the tax and the legal perspective to that discussion. And so we're going to have a good time with that today. Especially, we're going to have kind of I never know how to say this word, potpourri of fun listener questions. We often get listener questions that don't relate to a particular topic or to one topic that's big enough that we can cover for a whole program, but they're still very interesting and fun. So we're going to hit several of those today.
That's they'll be all over the board, and so we don't really know how to title our program except for fun listener questions. So, but we think they'll be very interesting. So, Rick, we always like to talk about things in the news that affect our wealth, and so we want the wealth news segment here. And so, why don't you jump into that? Tell us what you found.
Well, there's increasing evidence that the quote-unquote Affordable Care Act does exactly the opposite. It's neither affordable nor does it provide good care. The health insurance rates in Florida are projected to rise by 5 to 20% in the small group market, and 30 to 40% in the individual group, in the individual market. So if you're buying your insurance alone, it's going to jack up 30 or 40%. And this was announced by Florida's insurance commissioner, and one more state of money that have made similar announcements. And this at the same time that the Senate is floating legislation to exempt themselves and their aides and their various employees from having to participate in the Obamacare Act. So the politicians who want to shove this down everyone else's throats want to exempt themselves. And, of course, labor unions and other organizations have been clamoring to be exempted from the organization. And cleverly, the White House has extended the mandate for businesses to just after the next election cycle, so that the consequences can be delayed long enough to secure political positions, I assume. So anyway, we're seeing significant evidence that insurance rates are going up.
Well, and maybe the best thing for our listeners to do is you know, to throw their emails and support calls behind behind the group of lawmakers that are trying to defund Obamacare and just not allow any funding, because I think we still do have a constitution that requires Congress to approve funding, and so I'm sure there's an Obama way around that. But anyway, I think Mike Lee and other folks that are trying to defund Obamacare, maybe we should give them some support, because one way or the other, this is a train wreck. And and I think that's a quote from Max Baucus, who is one of the principal authors of the bill. So I'm not really sure. I don't think any of us are sure how these things happen, but they affect our wealth in a dramatic way. And I know that small business across the country is clamoring for relief from this. And so one way or the other, I think it's a disaster. And it's interesting, though. I saw on the news last night, you still have the Democrats out there saying that rates are going to go down, that many of the states' health insurance rates have done exactly what they're expected to do. They went down. CARE is up. But I think they're delusional.
I think that's the spin. That's the story that they want to believe. They think if they repeat the same lie often enough, that enough people will believe it, that it will be okay. But practical reality is a little more harsh.
I think that was the Nazi a spin machine. That's to say the lie long enough, people start believing. So,
well, you know, an interesting trend. I know that you and I have both seen this with our clients. I've actually, in the last week, a question we could talk about today is, how do I keep my employee base below 50 so that I can avoid this compulsory compliance with the Obamacare Act? And I've actually had multiple clients, a significant number of clients, decide not to expand their business, to say, this, I'm big enough. I will grow no bigger. I'm hiring no more people. I could make more money. I could expand my business, but I'm not going to, because the cost and the overhead and is just so ridiculous. It's not worth it. So, you know, the economy's the thing, we're being told, but then they punish people who grow jobs, so they're not going to grow jobs. Which brings us to the next news item. A recent survey from AP News Organization with exclusive data collected by the Associated Press, that 4 out of 5 U.S. adults struggle with joblessness, near poverty, or reliance on welfare for at least part of their lives. And this survey looks not just at what's happening now, but what happens leading up to retirement age. And it's most of us at one point or another rely on food stamps or a variety of forms of government assistance or live at or below the poverty line. And it's the racial divide, contrary to what a lot of the people who race agitators want us to believe, the racial divide is actually narrowing. Although non-white minorities are still more heavily impacted by adverse economic news than any other group, the number of whites in this category has risen dramatically. And it's hitting everybody. The notion that you can be exempted from economic struggles because of your color is fading fast. Bad economic policies are colorblind, and they hit everybody, and we're seeing the effect of that.
You know, Rick, that leads into the next news item, and that is that we all know that poverty, and particularly child poverty, is an ongoing national concern, but it seems like most people aren't really aware of its principal cause. And the principal cause actually is the deterioration of the American family. Whether you're, as you mentioned earlier, whether it doesn't matter the color of your skin, but the absence of married fathers in the home is the principal cause. And this is a study that, and a conclusion that's been reached by a number of studies, but the poverty rate for single parents with children in 2009 was 37.1%. And during the same time period, the rate for married couples with children, the poverty rate was 6.8%. So being raised in a family, in a married family, reduced a child's probability of living in poverty by about 82%. So others, folks have said, well, you know, maybe it's an education level kind of thing. But and even though that does contribute some, even when married couples are compared to single parents with the same level of education, the married poverty rate will still be more than 75% lower. So marriage is the most powerful weapon in fighting poverty, and and some studies have indicated that being married has the same effect in reducing poverty that adding 5 or 6 years to a parent's level of education has.
Wow.
So, so I guess the takeaway there is get married, stay married, and if you don't want to be in poverty, that's your best insurance against that.
And you know, kind of a related trend, and we have mentioned this statistic on our show before, but this last year in 2012, for the first time in our nation's history, the number of children, or the percentage of children born to unwed parents, now is greater than 50%. For the longest time, for the first 200 years of our existence as a nation, and even before that, with the quote-unquote traditional family, traditional society, the percentage of children to unwed parents hovered right at or below 5%. That's been the trend for actually hundreds of years, and it started to climb upward in the 60s, and now it's north of 50%, which means that if you think about it, if 50% of the children are born to unwed parents, and then within the first 7 years of the lives of children born to parents that are married, 50% of those households divorce. So it pushes about 75% of children end up in today's demographics are going to end up growing up in single parent homes, which, as we've pointed out, those children, 82% of them will live in poverty, which is just mind blowing, which means that we're not thinking through the long-term consequences of the social attitude towards family. And there's been this idea that, recreational sex is, you know, an adult decision and has no adverse social consequences, and that's just not borne out by the facts. It's just contrary to reality, and people are short-sighted when they don't see this. So let's talk about some happy things. We have a wonderful quote, our quote of the week, Rich. Share us our quote of the week.
All right. The quote this week is, when one door of happiness closes, another opens. But often we look so long at the closed door that we do not see the one that has been opened for us. And that's by Helen Keller. So interesting that she talks a lot there about looking at things, but yeah. She could not. So, but that's a great quote. So
I love that. Yeah. And how often is that the case, that we look at what we've lost instead of what we've gained? Let's talk for a little bit about our give back story. This is kind of interesting. We go looking for these every week, and I found one that I really, really like. Athletes from the London 2012 Olympic and Paralympic Games have made thousands of appearances in schools and communities to inspire the next generation through sport. This was announced by the Cultural Secretary of the United Kingdom. In an interview, she said that of the 172 London 2012 medalists who reported back, it was estimated that 77% of them have made at least one appearance at a school or community function. And 45% of those London 2012 medalists have made five or more visits. And 10 sports have averaged five appearances or more per athlete. So, you know, I think it's really cool. And I'm very familiar. I have a client and a dear friend who's an Olympic athlete, kind of an Olympic family. And they have given extensive time and energy in organizing them, not only their own lives, but the lives of other Olympic athletes to go into the community, go into schools and promote fitness and health and excellence and personal performance. And I think that's just a wonderful thing to see. So that's our give back story. And I want to applaud the people that are participating in that, and hope that our listeners can find some inspiration to in their own lives to find a way to give back to the communities.
Great. Rick, thank you for that. We do have two or three minutes before we go to break, so I think we ought to at least introduce and maybe talk a little bit about the first listener question that we have here. And so the question is this, Rick, is it better to pay off your home fast or slow? In other words, if you have the money, should you just get it paid off, or should you keep the money and do something else?
You know, I've had that question a lot over the years, and actually had it in the last week from two different people. The idea kind of is, well, there's – couple of benefits from not paying off your mortgage. The one is the mortgage interest deduction on your taxes, which is kind of a bizarre to me, but that would be construed as a benefit. But then the other one is, well, money's so cheap right now. The interest rate on my home is so low that I can put that money to work somewhere in some one investment or another, and so why should I pay off my home now? So that tax benefit of paying mortgage interest and putting my money to work is the reason, to not pay off your mortgage. On the pay off your mortgage side, there's the question of security. You know, if you can hit retirement and not have a house payment, are you going to be better off or worse off? If you can have the emotional and financial security of having your house paid off, is that better than having some pot of money working for you? And I want to, when we come back from the break, we need to go to break now, but when we come back from break, I'm going to tell you a story about a friend and neighbor of mine who borrowed money against his home that had been paid off free and clear for a number of years, and he borrowed money from his home so that he could invest in some real estate rental properties. And we'll tell you what happened with him when we come back from break.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Live well and leave a legacy. Durfee Law Group offers dynasty estate planning and asset protection services so you can do just that. We focus on helping our clients gain maximum protection and privacy by providing the right tools and innovative strategies to sustain both immediate and long-term success. Call us today to set up a complimentary consultation. Call 480-324-8000. That's 480-324-8000. Or visit our website at www.durfeelawgroup.com. That's D-U-R-F-E-E lawgroup.com. We'll help you turn the gift of wealth into a blessing for your heirs rather than a curse.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Rich, and I'm the CPA.
And this is Rick. I'm the lawyer.
And this is What About Wealth? And our topic this hour is fun listener questions. So just before the break, Rick, we were talking about whether or not to pay off your home, and you were going to tell us a story about that. So let's get right into that because we've got a lot of other questions to cover today.
Right. So this friend and neighbor of mine had a very nice home. It had been paid off for more than a decade, and he was at or retirement age and was looking around and thought, oh, okay, I need – one more roll of the dice. I hate to put it in those terms. And he did not use that word, but that's how I see it. But he was looking around and said, gee, all my friends have gotten rich, in the real estate market. So his home was worth a lot of money and he borrowed against it. And he was actually very conservative. He only borrowed 50% of the value of his home. And he purchased several rental properties, and even with those, he put big down payments on them so that he had about 50% equity in those homes, and the rent from the homes was paying the mortgages, and everything was wonderful and beautiful. And then we all know the real estate bubble popped, and it was bloody awful. Suddenly he couldn't rent his homes at a price that would cover the mortgage payment, and so he was feeding the mortgages on several rental properties. And then his employment situation changed, and he was unable to do that. So it was like dominoes falling down, plink, plink, plink. One at a time, he lost the rental properties. And then the value of his house, he was upside down in his house. It was terrible because it was less than 50% of what it was before. And he ended up losing his house. Now, another really wonderful family now lives in that home, and they're also my friend and my neighbor, and I like them a lot. But it was very, very tragic for this family that at or near retirement, they ended up losing their home that they had lived in for almost 30 years and had paid for. So, you know, on the question of should you pay off your home, even though I've had arguments from investment guys and financial managers that the cost of funds is so low right now and the opportunities in the investment world so great and it's just better off to put the money to work and pay your mortgage as you go. I feel like if I was going to make a mistake, I would err on the side of paying it off. And incidentally, there are a number of things you can do to accelerate the payoff of your home. And some of these people don't even know. One strategy is When you first refinance, you often kind of get a free month in there on your payments. And if you will go ahead and make that first mortgage payment, and you have to be a little ugly with your mortgage company because they don't like this. But make that first payment, and you have to tell them, apply this payment to principal. Just doing that will cut a 30-year mortgage down to about a 22 or 23-year mortgage, depending on your interest rate and a few things. Learning when your mortgage applies the interest, usually there's a day, and if you can make your payment the day before they apply the interest, that can cut down on time. So explore some of those rapid debt reduction strategies with your mortgage. My counsel is go ahead and pay it off. Paying it off is and coming into retirement with a paid off home is just better off than having a mortgage.
Yeah, I think the clients that I see, Rick, that seem to have the most flexibility and peace of mind are the ones that, you know, from an early age have decided that what they're going to do in their life is obviously get an education and figure out their profession or job and then pay off their home. And then once that's done, then that's the first time that they start thinking about investments. And, you know, it seems backwards to some people, but, you know, if you look at our, you know, especially today, everything is so volatile. And we don't have politically, we're in a mess. Financially, the country's in a mess. And I think we have to go back to kind of basic things and say, you know, if I'm going to be happy and survive this, certain things need to be taken care of so that I don't have to worry about them. And having a roof over your head is one of those. So I think it's great. You know, certainly, as you point out, financial guys will argue with us all day long about this, but I just think overall, probably a great idea. So,
you know,
answer to that question.
I want to add a couple of things to that because the financial guys do say, "Oh, it's just an emotional benefit to have your home paid off. It's strictly emotional. It's not practical." And that, in my opinion, that's simply not true. If you think about it, having your home paid off gives you much more staying power in an economic downturn. If times are rough, if properties are flip-flopping up and down in value, if the job market goes crazy, if there's inflation or not inflation, if the tax laws go crazy, having your home paid off gives you the ability to weather that storm. It also gives you the ability, and I've actually seen this a couple of times recently, gives you the ability to reinvent yourself. I've had a couple of clients in the last few years that with the change of the economy, have had to change careers or go back to school or deal with a healthcare crisis or things where they had to do something different for employment, for income than they were doing before. And having a paid off home gives them huge flexibility to do that they would not be able to do if they were struggling with a big, huge house payment. Mm-hmm. So it's not just emotional. It's very, very practical to have that thing paid off.
All right, so here's the next one. It's related, Rick, but should I walk from my home mortgage that is more than the value of my home?
So the upside down home. You know, that's a question that is interesting. I've had people construe that question as a moral question. I made this agreement that I would pay this mortgage, and now the fact that the market has turned against me and my mortgage is significantly more than my house is worth. And I've seen people, and I frankly respect and admire those that have done this, that have stuck it out, that have continued to pay the high house payment and have kept the house. But the practical matter is, in my view, the banks colluded in creating the real estate bubble that pushed the prices up and participated in creating that risk, and they were pushing that risk to the consumer. So it's not a moral defect to walk away from a house that you're upside down in and have that mortgage So what are the consequences? First of all, it's important to note that walking away from a house and having that foreclosure is going to show up on your credit report. And my response to that is, yeah, you and millions of other Americans are going to have that ding on their credit report. So that's not necessarily going to harm you in a catastrophic way to have that thing on your credit report. The other thing is, people are concerned about liability, and I know this is true in Arizona. What I'm about to tell you, it's also true in many other states. An important legal situation to be aware of is that on a personal residence, in most states, the loan on a personal residence is called a limited recourse loan. And what that means is the lender is limited in their remedies, if you default on that mortgage, to the recovery of the property. They are not permitted to come after a home buyer for a deficiency. Now, there are some exceptions to that that we can talk about, but let's consider what this means. This means that if you are upside down, you owe $100 and it's only worth $50, and you walk from the home, they cannot come back and sue you for the difference. Their remedy is limited to taking back the home, and that's a policy decision that we've made. The politicians have made that policy decision, I guess, but the effect of that is it puts the risk of lending money on a home and then having the value of that home collapse. It puts the risk of that on the lenders. And that's, by the way, the lenders don't really suffer. They're made whole by the taxpayers with federal insurance and HUD and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and all those fine institutions that create all these secondary markets for the homes that are put back in the banking system. So
let me jump in here, Rick, and say that even though that's true, what does happen to you on the tax side is not always so wonderful, and that is that we have these, you know, income due to the relief of debt.
Debt relief income. Yes.
Provisions, and so we end up with. You know, when people go through that sort of thing, yeah, they don't come and collect, but they say, well, guess what? You know, you got we forgave that debt, and so now you get to pick it up in income and pay tax on it.
But aren't they going to have enough cost in the property that it's going to offset?
Well, you know, personal residence is typically, I guess. You know, the tax rules are so weird there because you don't get any benefit for, you know, you don't can't take a loss, in other words, on selling your house, your personal residence, right? That's the one thing you can't take a loss on. And then, you know, of course the gain you don't have to pick up. So, it's kind of an ugly area because people, you know, as you point out, you can get out of it, but you also have this this thing hanging over your head potentially, and it isn't always the case, but something to be be aware of and to be concerned about. So,
I would say if you're thinking about walking from your home, so something that a lot of people don't realize is they skip their first payment and then they leave their house, and that's crazy. Stay in the house. Stay as long as you can. Stay until the sheriff's on your doorstep throwing you out, because in most places you get at least 6 months. And we have seen a number of cases in the last several years where the lenders simply decline to foreclose and are actually grateful that someone's living in the house taking care of it. I've had a client who reported to me that they have been in their home for actually years, more than two years, without making a payment. And the lender calls them every month and says, "Are you still in the home?" "Yeah, we're still here." "Oh, thank you." And and has not been requiring them to make payments and is not foreclosed on the home, they don't want to take the home back. Now, I think that might be a bizarre case, but at least take your 6 months before.
Yeah. You know, there's also the program, the HARP programs, I think they're called. So if you're, you know, if your loan's originated through Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, then you can refinance. See, that was a problem for a while here, where you obviously couldn't refinance if you were underwater. But that at least gives you the opportunity to do that. Sometimes allows people, you know, with that drop in interest rates, which could be significantly reduce your payment, allows people to stay in the home. So that's another avenue to explore, because it's actually fairly easy to do now and fairly inexpensive, and allows you to stay in the home, which most people would probably like to do. So
yeah,
consider that. So next question, and this is one that you and I get all the time. Is forming a Nevada corporation or LLC a good idea? Somehow people think that doing this in Nevada is a great thing. I guess that says a lot for Nevada's marketing. They're good at marketing gambling, and I guess they're good at this too. So what do you say, Rick? You're the attorney.
It's been promoted, and people have lots of wild ideas. If I have a Nevada LLC, I'm suddenly not going to have to pay personal income tax, or I'm going to have asset protection by virtue of having this entity. I've actually had people come in and say, "Oh yeah, I've got asset protection. My asset protection is done. I've got a Nevada corporation." Well, what does it own? Nothing. What are you doing with it? Well, nothing, but they paid for one. They have it, and it's sitting there. And the marketing people told them, "Oh, you get asset protection if you have this." You know, first of all, like anything, if you don't actually use the business entity, it's not going to do any good. And regardless of what jurisdiction you're in, how the entity is structured and owned has as much of an effect upon whether it's going to be useful for asset protection or even for tax planning as what the entity is or where it's structured. Under our legal system, corporations and LLCs and limited partnerships are all we get two different legal systems looking at them. On the one hand, they're taxed federally and their federal tax status is significant. But on the other hand, they are formed locally. And so we can, frankly, pick where to form these entities. And one of the advantages of having a multi-state practice like you and I do, Rich, is we get to look at lots and lots of different jurisdictions and what's good and what's not good. And often a critical part of the planning process is forum shopping, picking the most appropriate, the most advantageous place in which to form a business entity. And we have the whole country is wide open to us. Another question people ask that's kind of related is, can I, as an Arizona licensed attorney, form a business entity in another state? And the answer is, oh, yes, all day long, and we do. And I'm not practicing law in Nevada or Delaware or North Carolina or New Jersey or Colorado or anywhere else. We form these entities. We're practicing law right here in Arizona to form those entities. So, frankly, I always like to look at the local place where the client is doing business or owning property first. Now, that's not always best. There are some states that we, frankly, don't like and will avoid for forming business entities. But even if we form a business entity in Nevada or Wyoming or Alaska or Arizona, if the property is owned somewhere else, that foreign entity has to be registered to do business in the state where it owns property or does business. And in fact, the failure to do so has some pretty catastrophic consequences. I actually represented a client once in a I don't litigate and was not litigating in this time. I didn't have to litigate because we got rid of the litigation because the plaintiff was a foreign business entity that had failed to register to do business in Arizona, and it was a one-punch knockout. We told the court that, and the case was summarily dismissed, and they were thrown out and not able to bring their legal action because they weren't registered to do business in Arizona. So wherever you're going to do business, that entity has to be registered, which, by the way, one of the issues that we get told is the privacy thing. Oh, I want to keep my identity private. And Nevada is not the best place for that, actually. Delaware's a little better than that. Wyoming's pretty good for that, for the privacy issue.
But in any case, Rick, if you're actually doing business somewhere else, and most of our clients are, they're just looking for this magic bullet. If you're doing business somewhere else, you still have to register there. So how good of a job did you do at keeping yourself?
Yeah, it clobbers the privacy.
Right. So we have to go to break now, but when we come back, we've got several other listener questions we want to cover in our last segment. So we'll be back to you in a couple of minutes.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Live well and leave a legacy. Durfee Law Group offers dynasty estate planning and asset protection services so you can do just that. We focus on helping our clients gain maximum protection and privacy by providing the right tools and innovative strategies to sustain both immediate and long-term success. Call us today to set up a complimentary consultation. Call 480-324-8000. That's 480-324-8000. Or visit our website at www.durfeelawgroup.com. That's D-U-R-F-E-E lawgroup.com. We'll help you turn the gift of wealth into a blessing for your heirs rather than a curse.
Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business.
You are tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Welcome back. This is Rick. I'm the lawyer.
And this is Rick, Rich, and I'm the CPA.
And this is What About Wealth? And our topic today is fun listener questions. And I want to, before we go to the next question, just kind of conclude that Nevada Corporation or LLC question by saying that the best location for your business entity depends. And that's one of the things you owe it to yourself to get good advice from somebody who is experienced in helping clients select a jurisdiction for their business entities, because we use many, many jurisdictions, and it just depends on what we're trying to do and what we're doing it with.
That's exactly right. And good summation. Okay, so next question here, which I'm going to tackle here, is when will my workers be considered an employee versus an independent contractor? So we get that question quite a bit, Rick. It's and especially like when you've got Obamacare coming in, this becomes an even more important question for people, because obviously if you can hire contractors, that's one way to stay under, you know, the 50 employee limit. So there's some really important things here. And it's not a new question, certainly, but it's one that is important. And so we're gonna try to discuss this a little bit and give our listeners some idea, because I think It's important, and we need to really understand it, because not understanding it and thinking that you've got contractors that are really employees can be somewhat devastating and painful if that ever gets brought to light. So you kind of have to look at this, and the IRS looks at this in kind of three categories that you have to look at. And when you're thinking about a worker that you have, you need to think about the behavioral control that you have over that person, the financial control that you have over that person, and then the relationship of that worker and your company. And so I'm just going to give some examples here of things that impact behavioral control. Let's start there. What training or instruction do you give this person? So anyway, in other words, if you don't give them training and you don't really give them instruction, then more likely that they're a contractor. And who gives them work assignments? How do they get those work assignments? And what I mean by that is, if someone comes in every day and you say, okay, do this, do this, do this, then very likely they're an employee. If instead there's a very general, hey, this is what you do, and they get to decide when they do it and how they do it, then that's more of a contractor. You have to look at if there's a problem or a complaint in the work, who is supposed to resolve that. If the company resolves it, that's more like an employee. If that person resolves their own problems, and then you have to look at what types of reports are required from this worker. So, if you're an employee, obviously, a report is required any time. But if you're a contractor, the reporting is going to be a lot less, the control, it's kind of a control thing. That's a lot less. And so also you look at the location. Does this person have to come to a certain place to do this, or can they do it from where they choose to do it from? Maybe they do it from their own office or their home or some other location, and you looking at the percentage of time that person spends, in the company's offices versus somewhere else, that has a significant impact on whether or not they're an employee or a contractor. Same thing about meetings. Are they required to attend meetings? Now, are there penalties for not attending meetings? Obviously, if there are, then that's more of an employee. If there aren't, then it's a contractor. Does the person have to provide services personally, or can they hire someone to do it? If you're a contractor, for example, I'm considered a contractor as a CPA for lots of firms that I do work for. I can hire people to do a lot of that work, to prepare tax returns or do bookkeeping or whatever. So obviously that gives you a good argument that you're a contractor. Flipping over to financial control, Rick, there are things in this area that kind of impact our, does this person show up at work and you provide them a place to work, or do they have to rent their own space or their own equipment? Do you provide them equipment? Or, for example, do you provide them a computer, or do they have to have their own computer to do work? Obviously, one is more employee, the other is employer. And what I want to point out is contractor. What I want to point out here is that there's not one of these that makes the determination one specific thing. It's kind of looking at the whole thing. And so the fact that maybe you provide somebody a computer who otherwise is a contractor probably does not make them be an employee. So this isn't a simple determination necessarily, but looking at all of them is what's important. Looking at, you know, our expenses reimbursed. Even the fact that you reimburse some expenses to a contractor does not mean they're an employee, but the more you do that, the more likely it is they're an employee. And you have to look at how the worker is paid. You know, are they paid a hourly wage or a lump sum? Is it piecework? All of those things impact on whether or not they're going to be considered an employee or a contractor. Do you have to carry workers' comp on if the company carries workers' comp on the insurance on this person? Well, if they do, they're probably more of an employee. If they don't, then a contractor. And who establishes the level of payment for services? Is that the company or is that the person? Well, if the person comes in and says, hey, this is what I do, this is what it costs, and the company says, okay, let's do it, then you're probably a contractor. But an employee, then the company would be saying, okay, this is what we pay for this kind of thing. Then kind of last but not least, you look at whether or not this person has benefits. The more benefits this person has, the more likely they're an employee. Who can terminate the relationship without incurring a liability or penalty? If that can happen, then, you know, it's very likely they're a contractor. Employees are a lot more tied in. And then you look, is this person providing similar services to someone else? And if during the same time that they're providing them to you, and if so, and also along with that, what if, do you have any restrictions on this person that says they can't provide those kind of services to other people? If you do, then they look a lot more like an employee. If you don't, then they're more like a contractor. So I think those are a lot of the important things. Obviously, if you're invoicing, if someone is invoicing the company for their services, that looks a lot like a contractor versus someone that just gets paid regularly, because that looks an awful lot like an employee. Does that person, the person providing service, they have a business entity that they work through? Well, if they do, then that is a good indication that they're a contractor. So, Rick, I'm sure you've seen this many times before too. What other things have you seen that might be helpful to our listeners on this subject?
I've actually helped not only clients. I've worked through this in house. I had a person who was an employee who wanted to become a contractor, and wanted to, in fact, this was a paralegal who wanted to do the work she was doing for me for other people. So we helped her form a business entity, and we branded it, and we helped her market it, and she invoiced us for what she did, and she invoiced other people for what she did. So she had her own company that she was running, and it was pretty obvious, I guess, that for the services, at least, that were going through that company, that she was not my employee, and in fact, I was not her only source of a business. So that to me is a big, huge one. I also like to look at, the person who has some kind of a professional credential or a certification, and then they bring their own tools and they come to solve a specific thing or do a specific thing, is it ongoing? That maybe this comes back to the relationship. Is it ongoing, or is it a, you brought them in to do X and then they're done? So the guy that comes in and I pay him to fix my computers one time, clearly he's not an employee. He's just a contractor that I hired to do a specific thing. That is an interesting question. I kind of want to – we have just a couple of minutes here. I want to hit this last question, which is I've actually had this question dozens of times in the last couple of months. Where can I go if the United States falls apart? If politically and economically, and you know, we have runaway inflation, we have the Constitution collapse, we have an increasing police state, all these horrible scenarios that may or may not be playing out. Where can I go? And there's a parade of places that promote themselves, places that I've had clients go. I've had clients move to Panama. I've actually had several do that, buy real estate in Panama or Belize or Puerto Rico or the British Virgin Islands or Singapore or and my last one that I'm going to put up, or France, really? Socialist France. And I want to have just in a last minute here, a recent survey from UBS has shown that the French work the least amount of hours per year of any country in the world. People work on average 1,902 hours per year. They work a lot longer in Asia and Middle Eastern countries. They work a lot longer in the U.S. But people in France, they only work 1,582 hours. So it's almost a 320 some odd hour difference a year, which you do the math, that's a lot of days. And you might think, well, gee, does that mean that they're just lazy, or does that mean that they're more productive? And I do not know the answer to that. I do know that I had a client recently that was involved in a movie project and had working with a French company, and the Americans were, we've got to get this done on this schedule. And they were all uptight about the scheduling and concerned about the contractors that they were paying. And the French one said, hey, we're French. We don't work on this. And they just left. And the Americans were very, very frustrated because they wanted to work overtime and get the job done. So who knows? I frankly don't know. I've helped clients go to all of those places we mentioned. I've helped them actually come away from those places too. And for every one that I've helped leave the U.S., I've helped a couple come back. So I don't know that I have a good answer on where to go if the U.S. falls apart. Do you have something, Rich, that you can add to that?
No, I don't. but I think it's a good thing to be thinking about. So,
if I knew, I would go there. Even as bad as it gets, in fact, I had an economist that I heard a year ago talk about why the U.S. currency has not collapsed. And the answer was, as bad as it is here in the U.S., it's worse everywhere else. And that's, I think, going to continue to be the answer. And we'll have to sign off today from our fun listener questions. This is What About Wealth? Give us a call. Come visit us on our website. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you for listening to What About Wealth with hosts Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. Please join us again for another edition next Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Until then, have a profitable week.